My mother always said they were different. That a prediction is a fluid thing, a vision of an event that might sometimes be influenced by people and their choices, so that the outcome couldn't be clearly seen. A prophecy, she said, is far more concrete. It's a true vision of the future, impossible to alter unless someone with certain knowledge interfered. Certain knowledge? Cassie nodded. Suppose a psychic had a prophetic vision of a newspaper headline that stated 100 people died in a hotel fire. She knows she won't be believed if she tries to warn them, so she does the only thing she can. Goes to the hotel and sets off a fire alarm before the actual fire is discovered. The people get out. But the hotel burns just the same. The headline she saw will never exist, but the event that generated it will happen. Abby was listening so intently that she was actually leaning forward over the table. Then a prophecy can be changed, but only partly. That's what I've been told. The problem for the psychic is knowing whether her interference will alter the prophecy or bring it about, just as she saw it. How can she know that? According to some, she can't. I'd lean that way myself. Interpreting what you see is difficult enough. Trying to figure out if your own warning or interference is the catalyst that will bring about the very outcome you're trying to avoid. I just don't see how it's possible to do anything but guess. And if the stakes are high enough, a wrong guess could have a very costly price tag. Yes. Abby dropped her gaze to her coffee. Yes, I see that. Cassie hesitated, then said, If you don't mind my asking, what did Aunt Alex tell you? A prediction of your destiny? Or a prophecy? Abby drew a breath and met Cassie's gaze, a little smile wavering on her lips. A prophecy. She said, She told me I would die at the hands of a madman. Chapter 8. After he dropped off Cassie at the garage, Ben had a brief meeting at his office with the public defender about an upcoming case, then fielded several calls from concerned citizens regarding the murders, or more specifically, what he was going to do about them. His job demanded tact and patience, and he used both. But as he hung up the phone after the third call, he was uneasily aware that the mood of the town was already beginning to shift from panic to anger. And there were too damned many guns in too many angry hands. Knowing that Eric Stevens would be calling him soon to find out what he should print in the newspaper in response to citizen demands for official advice on how to be safer, he began jotting down a list on a legal pad. Matt would be asked first, of course, and he would offer these same practical suggestions before getting impatient and telling Eric to ask Ben so he could get back to his investigation. Matt usually knew the right answers, but seldom trusted his own instincts. Sometimes it worried Ben. Janice buzzed from her office. A call, Judge. It's your mother. Thanks, Janice. He picked up the receiver. Hi, Mary. What's up? He had called his mother by her name, at her request, from the time he was a boy. The habit was so ingrained now he seldom even thought about it.
Ben, these awful murders.
The little girl, breathless voice that his father had at first found charming, and then, as the years passed, utterly exasperating, was filled with worry and horror.
And Jill. The poor, poor thing.
I know, Mary. We'll catch him. Don't worry.
Is it true Ivy Jameson was killed in her own kitchen?
I'm afraid so.
And Jill in her shop? Ben, what kind of a monster could be doing this?
Avoiding the obvious retort that if they knew that, the monster would be more easily captured. Ben said patiently, I don't want you to upset yourself, Mary. You've got a good security system and the dogs. Keep them with you when you're out in the garden.
It's just that I'm so far from town, she said.
Ben started to repeat that she would be fine, but then remembered his missed opportunity to warn Jill. Could he live with himself if something like that happened again? I'll tell you what. I should be finished here by 5 at the latest. I'll come out to the house and check all the locks. Make sure the security system is working properly. All right?
And stay to supper? I'll fix that chicken dish you like so much.
He thought fleetingly of his half-formed intention to call Cassie and offer to bring Chinese takeout to her place that evening, and bit back a sigh. Sure. That sounds great, Mary. I should be there between 5:30 and 6.
Bring some wine, she chirped merrily. See you then.
Right. Ben hung up the phone and rubbed the back of his neck wearily. He didn't feel a bit disloyal to his father in wishing his mother would find a kind widower and remarry. She needed a man around, and failing a romantic interest, she naturally turned to her son. For everything. It wasn't a role Ben enjoyed. Growing up the only child of a young, emotionally volatile mother, and a much older, coldly distant, manipulative father, he had, more often than not, felt like a punching bag. It hadn't helped that his own personality was an uneasy mixture of his genetic heritage. Every bit as emotionally sensitive and impulsive as his mother, he had also inherited his father's intellectual detachment, innate wariness, and ability to cloak his feelings behind either charm or coldness. The mix made him a good lawyer. He wasn't at all sure it made him a good man. He was certain it made him a lousy lover. Jill had deserved better. All she had wanted from him had been emotional closeness, an intimacy beyond the physical, and since they had been seeing each other for several months by that point, she had certainly been entitled to ask. In response, he had only grown cooler and more distant, burying himself in work and offering her less and less of his time, his attention, himself. Even then, Ben had realized what he was doing, yet he'd been powerless to do anything else. He had valued her love, but her conspicuous need of him had made him feel obligated. Not obligated to commit himself to her, but to open himself to her. And it was something he was simply unable to do. He didn't know why that was true. But he did know that Jill had not been the only woman in his life whose attempts to get closer to him had been rebuffed, only the most recent. After weeks of distancing himself, he had coolly suggested that their relationship was simply not working. Jill hadn't been very surprised, and she hadn't subjected him to an emotional scene, but her unhappiness had been obvious. She had deserved better. Ben felt that he'd abandoned her twice. First, because he hadn't been able to love her, and then, before her death, when a warning from him might have made a difference. Judge? He looked up with a start to find his secretary standing in the open doorway. Yes, Janice.
The sheriff called while you were on with your mother. He wants you to come by his office before 6, if you can. He says he's found out something interesting about a piece of evidence in these murders.
Tell Sheriff Dunbar, Cassie said immediately. A prediction about dying at the hands of a madman would be terrifying enough to live with normally, she thought. But with a serial killer stalking the town, it became more than imperative that Abby take some steps to protect herself. And even though they had just met, Cassie had seen too many scenes of violence recently not to feel a chill of fear for Abby. Abby's smile wavered even more.
What makes you think I haven't already?
A hunch.
Pretty good one.
Why haven't you told him?
Because he wouldn't believe it. He's an atheist. Did you know that?
Cassie shook her head.
Yes.
He goes to church because it's politically expedient, but he considers religion nothing more than myth and superstition. She paused, then added, in other words, on a par with psychic ability. If there is no God, there can be no magic, Cassie murmured. Something like that. Cassie sighed. It's so difficult for most people to believe that it's just another sense, like sight or hearing, that they don't have it because nothing in their genetic makeup or experience triggered that part of their brain to begin working instead of lying dormant. I have black hair and gray eyes and psychic ability, all perfectly normal for me, all handed down in my family for generations. If they could just understand there's nothing magical about it. Matt will probably never understand, Abby said. It's just too alien to him. He wouldn't be listening to you at all if it weren't for Ben. But even when they were kids, Ben was always the one trying new things, and Matt always followed Ben's lead. She lowered her voice. Plus, you knew we were seeing each other, and that shook him up more than he'll admit. But he's not at all inclined to put any faith in psychic ability. Surely he'd heed a threat to you. He'd think Miss Melton was just trying to scare me, for some undoubtedly mercenary reason. He never knew your aunt, and he'd never believe how upset she was when she told me, how reluctant. Cassie shook her head. That's the part I don't understand. You mean, why she'd tell me I was doomed? Exactly. As a rule, prophecies tend to herald some kind of tragedy, but no responsible psychic would offer such a warning to someone if there was nothing they could do to change a terrible fate. Cassie kept her voice matter of fact. Abby frowned. I hardly knew her, of course, but I got the distinct feeling it was something she didn't want to tell me. She seemed to force herself to get the words out, and she kept repeating that the future was never static, that human will could influence fate. Then she thought you could change what she saw. Or else just wanted to soften the blow. Cassie shook her head. If that were the case, why tell you at all? I can't believe she was cruel, and to offer you a bleak and unalterable vision of the future would definitely be cruel. No. My guess is that she told you because she thought if you knew, you could do something to avoid the fate she saw for you. Such as? I wish I knew. Sometimes avoiding an event is as simple as turning left instead of right at the next traffic light you encounter. She sighed. I'm sorry. I wish there was something more helpful I could tell you. But even if I had my aunt's gift, I'd still have to interpret what I saw. There are so many possible outcomes for any situation. That's what your aunt said. I don't know what I'd do in your shoes, Cassie said. But telling the sheriff would be a good start. He told me he'd known a few people who were deceived by psychics, but surely he'd pay attention to a warning concerning you, especially when it was given by a woman with nothing to gain. He's more likely to get mad at me for taking the warning seriously. To him, it's always some kind of con. Abby paused, then added, he's convinced you're conning them. I know. He's a good man, but he can be stubborn as hell. Cassie smiled. His mistrust doesn't bother me much. Or hasn't, so far. So far, it hasn't been costly. You think it will be? If I manage to pick up some useful information and he ignores it because he doesn't trust me, you bet it could be costly. She shook her head. But right now, I'm more concerned about you. Reading the good sheriff told me more than you'd probably like about your personal life. I know you have a husband you're separated from, and I know he's capable of violence. Add to that one maniac who's killed 3 women so far, and I'd say it might be a good time for you to take a vacation and go lie on a beach somewhere. Abby's unsteady smile returned.
And what if my leaving here and going somewhere else is just another step toward my fate?
That's a possibility. But I'd have to say the odds are more in your favor on that beach.
Maybe. But I can't leave.
Then at least tell the sheriff. If you can't make him believe that my aunt could see into the future, at least convince him her warning frightened you. Maybe he can take steps to make your life safer.
And maybe it would just be one more thing for him to worry about.
I'm being careful. That's all I can do. Cassie admired her calm. Since she had lived often with the knowledge that some madman could possibly zero in on her, that her odds of becoming a victim were better than most, she knew only too well how debilitating that constant threat was. Even more, she knew how it felt to live with the prophecy of doom. She almost told Abby, almost confided that her only experience with precognition had been a vision of her own fate that promised violence and destruction. But in the end, she kept that knowledge to herself. She had run 3,000 miles, only to find herself once again entangled in an investigation of crimes of violence. For her, running had not been an escape. There was nothing to be gained by telling Abby that.
"Do you have a dog?"
she asked instead.
"No."
"Maybe you should get one, or borrow one."
"Do you have one?"
Cassie smiled.
"No. But Ben said I should get one, and he was right. Look, do you want to take a trip with me out to the animal shelter?"
"The coins," Matt said. "What about them?" Ben sat down in one of the visitors' chairs in front of the sheriff's desk. "We may have caught a break with them. The silver dollar found in Becky's hand turns out to be a pretty rare specimen. I don't understand the technical details. Something about a flaw in the mold. They were never circulated, and only a few thousand were minted before the mistake was caught."
"A few thousand?"
"I know it sounds like a lot, but they all went to collectors, Ben, and they're very valuable."
"Does that mean they're traceable?"
"It means they might be. I've got somebody working on that now."
"How about the other coins?"
Matt shook his head. "We're still checking on those, but they look damn close to mint quality to me. If so, if he's using only uncirculated coins, then they've pretty well got to be from somebody's collection."
"We have any coin collectors in town?"
"Yeah, several that we know of. It isn't exactly an uncommon hobby. We're quietly pulling together a list."
"And then?"
"Start asking questions, as discreetly as possible. I don't want everybody in town knowing that coins are part of the murder investigation, so we've cooked up a story about a stolen coin collection. It won't fool anyone for long, but with luck, it'll give us a head start."
"Maybe not much of one," Ben said. "From what I've been hearing today, rumors are already circulating that the victims were holding something when they were found."
"Shit."
"We both knew it was just a matter of time."
"Yeah, but I was hoping for days rather than hours. Damn it, how did that get out? My people have been threatened with fines and or jail time if I find out anybody discussed this investigation outside the office."
Ben shrugged. "Osmosis. If there's a secret in this town, it will get out. Guaranteed."
Matt scowled at him. "That psychic of yours hasn't been talking, has she?"
"I doubt it." "When are you going to get off her case, Matt? She's done nothing except try to help."
"Like that business a few hours ago? The killer's right-handed and probably tried to kill himself at some point by slashing his wrists."
"You didn't believe her?"
"No."
Tell me you at least added right-handed and possible attempted suicide scar to your list of identifying characteristics.
I did. But I'm not expecting either to help. Right-handed I'd already gotten from Doc Monroe anyway, a fact he gleaned logically from the wounds. As for that supposed scar, this is a town where more than half the men work in mills and plants, and injuries to the hands and lower arms are common. I think she realized that. I think she guessed right-handed because it's likely, and added the scar in for color.
What is she going to have to do to convince you she's genuine?
A lot more than she has done.
Ben rose to his feet, shaking his head.
You're so damn stubborn. It'll cost you one day, Matt.
Maybe, but not today. I'll call you if we find out anything else.
Do that. I'll be out at Mary's this evening, but I don't plan to stay more than a couple of hours.
She nervous?
Of course. I promised to check out her security system.
Tell her I'm stepping up the regular patrols out there as of tonight.
I will. Thanks.
Don't mention it. Matt smiled faintly.
Ben lifted a hand in farewell and left the sheriff's office. Not one to put off unpleasant duties, he drove out of town to the house where he'd grown up. His father had insisted on calling the big bastard Tudor house and its 100 acres of rolling pasture land an estate, but Ben refused to. He also refused to call it home. He pressed the button on the intercom rather than ringing the doorbell, and wasn't surprised when his mother's cheerful voice bade him enter. The door wasn't locked. However, since he was greeted in the foyer by two enormous mastiffs, it could hardly be said the house was unprotected.
Hey, guys.
He patted the broad, heavy heads of the two dogs, who were clearly delighted to see him. His mother had named them Butch and Sundance, and either would instantly die to protect her, but otherwise they were placid and friendly dogs who enjoyed familiar visitors. They walked on either side of Ben as he went through the house to the kitchen, where he found his mother.
"The breeder has a new litter of puppies," Mary Ryan said as soon as they came in. "You should get one, Ben. You love dogs, and they love you."
"I don't need a mastiff in my apartment," he told her, patient with an old argument.
"You could pick a smaller breed."
"I don't need a dog in my apartment. With my hours, it wouldn't be fair to keep any kind of pet."
She sent him a glance from her position at the center work island, where she was chopping ingredients for a salad. She was a tall, slender woman who had passed on to her son her own gleaming dark hair and hazel eyes. Her little girl voice was incongruous. A husky, smoky voice would have been more in keeping with her looks. She was not yet 60, and looked 20 years younger.
"You need a companion, Ben," she said. "You spend too much time alone."
"You haven't seen my workload lately," he retorted.
She was, of course, discussing his wifeless state, though she invariably approached the subject indirectly. Knowing she would go on and on discussing it unless he distracted her, he set the bottle of wine he'd brought on the counter, took off his suit jacket, and draped it over a barstool at the island and said,
"I'll go ahead and check all the windows and doors, all right?"
"Supper will be ready in 20 minutes.
He hoped the subject was going to be dropped, but when they were sitting at the informal breakfast table half an hour later, she brought it up again.
"A kitten, then. Maybe two of them. Cats are quite happy being left on their own for hours, and at least there'd be someone for you when you came home."
Ben sipped his wine to give himself a moment, then said calmly,
"Mary, I promise you, I don't lack for company. I've just been very busy lately, and haven't had much time for dating."
She grimaced slightly when he bluntly replaced cats with women, but followed his lead to ask a direct question of her own.
"What about Alexandra Melton's niece?"
He was startled.
"How the hell did you hear about her?"
"Louise told me. You know we always do the flowers for the church on Saturday. She said she'd seen you at least twice with Alexandra Melton's niece, that there was no mistaking the girl. Is she as interesting as her aunt was, Ben?
I hardly knew Miss Melton.
And her niece?
I barely know her.
But what's she like?
Ben gave up. Mary, for all her childish voice and moods, could be as relentless as water dripping on stone when she wanted something. She looks a lot like Miss Melton, yes. Black hair, gray eyes. Smaller, though, and more fragile.
Alexandra was a bit fey. Is her niece? And what is her name, anyway?
Her name is Cassie Neal.
Ben frowned.
I wasn't aware you knew Miss Melton except by name.
We talked a few times over the years. For heaven's sake, Ben, you can't live in a town this size and not know most of the people. Not if you've been here nearly 40 years.
He nodded, but said, "What do you mean by fey?"
Well, just that. She knew things. Once, she told me to hurry home because Gretchen, Butch and Sonny's mother, you remember her, was having her puppies and there was trouble. And there was, too. I lost her and had to hand-rear the boys.
One of the boys thumped his tail against the tile floor, and the other yawned hugely as Ben glanced at them. Looking back at his mother, he said, "I'd heard a few stories about her seeming to know things, and didn't really believe them. But Cassie says her aunt was supposed to be able to predict the future."
Then maybe she could. Can Cassie?
Ben shook his head. No.
Because you don't believe it's possible, or because she told you she couldn't?
Mary asked, intent. Because she told me she couldn't.
Ben didn't see any reason to tell his mother that Cassie's psychic skills lay in quite another direction. Mary was disappointed. Oh, I was hoping maybe she could.
So she could tell your fortune? Ben asked dryly.
Mary lifted her chin. As a matter of fact, Alexandra did that. After the thing with the puppies, I asked her if she could tell me anything about my future. She sort of laughed, and then she said that because of my son, I'd meet a tall, dark, and handsome man I'd fall madly in love with and soon marry.
It sounded so much like the sort of stock prediction common in sideshow fortune-tellers' tents that Ben could say only, "Oh, for God's sake, Mary."
It might come true. You don't know.
Ben sighed. Sure it might.
She stared at him. You know, son, you are far too cynical, even for a lawyer.
Since she called him son only when she was seriously annoyed with him, and since Mary annoyed with him could lead to uncomfortable interludes in his life, Ben said contritely, I know. Sorry, Mary. I'm just not sure I believe in precognition, that's all. And it was the truth, even if not all of it. Somewhat mollified, she said,
You should open up your mind, Ben. Your imagination.
I'll work on that. She eyed him.
You're just humoring me.
For your sake, I hope Miss Melton's prediction comes true. If I notice a tall, dark stranger lurking around, I'll definitely invite him here for supper.
Now I know you're just humoring me.
But she seemed more amused than annoyed. Accustomed to her swift changes of mood, Ben merely said, Not at all. Fix this chicken dish for him, and I can guarantee he'll be impressed. You're a great cook, and you know it.
She sipped her wine, her eyes bright as she watched him across the table. Can Cassie cook?
I wouldn't know.
You like her, don't you?
Yes, I like her.
He kept his voice patient and matter-of-fact.
No more and no less. Liar. Stop matchmaking, Mary. The last time...
He bit off the rest, but it was too late.
Mary's face changed and her eyes filled with quick tears.
I was so hoping you and Jill would stay together. She was such a sweet girl, Ben. Even after you broke up, she came to visit me and talk about you.
He hadn't known that. It seemed that Cassie had been right yet again when she told him that Jill was an ex-lover not yet ready to let go. Mary.
Who could have done that to such a sweet girl, Ben? And Ivy, and that poor girl, Becky. What's happening to this town? Who will that monster kill next?
Everything will be all right, Mary.
But...
Listen to me. Everything will be all right. Recognizing the signs of rising hysteria in his mother, he set himself to the task of reassuring her. He kept his voice level and calm, his words encouraging, and refused to allow her to work herself into a state of panic that would demand sedatives and his presence in the house overnight. It was a condition he knew her quite capable of achieving. And not for the first time, he felt a flash of reluctant sympathy for his dead father. Ben had called the previous afternoon to check on her, he said, and he was relieved to hear she had adopted a dog. He hadn't been able to tell her anything about the investigation. Another tricky case was keeping him in court more than he had expected, and he'd gotten little opportunity to talk to Matt. He had sounded tired and a little restless. The newspaper hadn't had much to say either, beyond a few stark facts. Becky Smith had been buried, but funerals for the other two victims were postponed indefinitely while the search for evidence continued. Probably smart of the sheriff, but the lack of closure was not helping the mood of the townspeople. With two bodies lying in refrigerated storage at one of the local undertakers, and a visibly increased police presence throughout the county, no one was going to forget the potential threat. No curfew had been declared, but the newspaper reported unusually quiet streets after dark, and women traveling in pairs, groups, or with male escorts virtually at all times. If Cassie had been an optimist, she might have brought herself to hope that the killer had left and moved on to other hunting grounds. She was not an optimist. And she was more than half convinced the sheriff was right, that this killer was local, someone born and bred in the area, and still there, somewhere. Realizing what she was doing, acknowledging silently that it was not, after all, so easy to forget, Cassie pushed thoughts of the killer firmly from her mind. "Enough," she said out loud. Max dashed up to her with a stick, and she spent the next 15 minutes or so throwing it for him. She tired of the game before he did. He was still carrying the stick in his mouth when Cassie started back toward the house. He dropped it the instant he saw the jeep parked in the driveway, and his full-throated barks rang out across the field, oddly hollow in the cold, still air. Cassie saw Ben come down the steps from the porch and look in their direction, and caught Max by the collar to keep him by her side. "Max, heel," she told him firmly. He stopped barking, but was growling low in his throat by the time they got within a few feet of the visitor. "Hi," she greeted Ben. "Hi." He was eyeing the dog.
"Well, he's big enough. Does he bite?"
"I don't know yet, though the shelter said he was gentle as a lamb the whole time they had him." Cassie glanced down at the still growling dog. Abandoned by people who apparently just didn't want to move him along with the furniture.
"It happens, sad to say. At least our shelter doesn't put them to sleep."
"That's what they told me." And that the younger Judge Ryan had been partly responsible for the shelter's policy of never euthanizing healthy animals. An interesting insight into his character. "Abby adopted one, too. Did you know?"
"Matt mentioned it."
Ben smiled.
"A very large Irish setter who loves to sleep with Abby. Matt wasn't entirely happy about that."
"I'll bet." Cassie wondered if Abby had confided in the sheriff about the prophecy, but decided not to ask. Max's growl got louder.
"You'd better introduce us," Ben said.
Cassie had little experience with dogs, but knew instinctively how it needed to be done. She told Max to sit, keeping one hand on the dog, and gestured for Ben to step closer. When he did, and after only the slightest hesitation, she reached out and took his hand. It was very warm, even on this cold winter day. "Max, this is Ben," she said steadily. "He's a friend." She guided Ben's hand close enough for the dog to sniff. Max either liked the way this new person smelled, or else accepted Cassie's reassuring touch. His tail thumped against the frozen ground, and the growling stopped. Ben petted the dog with a casual yet experienced ease and spoke to him kindly. By the time he straightened, Max was completely relaxed. "So far, so good," Cassie said. She released the collar and they watched as he went to investigate the tires of the Jeep.
"We'll see how he greets me the next time." Ben paused. "Does he sleep with you?"
Cassie decided not to take the question too personally. "He has a bed of his own beside mine. So far, he's stayed in it."
Ben nodded. "I'm glad you got him."
"So am I."
It was the truth.
She had discovered it was pleasant to have an attentive and undemanding companion who listened when she talked. And it had surprised her how much she had talked to the animal.
"I'm sorry to drop in on you without calling."
Ben's voice held that same restless note she had heard when he called the previous night.
"But I was out this way, and..."
Cassie allowed the silence to last only a moment. "It's cold out here. Why don't we go inside? It'll just take a few minutes to warm up the coffee."
"That sounds good. Thanks."
Max left off investigating the Jeep to accompany them, and as usual, followed Cassie into the kitchen.
"He sticks close,"
Ben observed from the doorway. "So far." She glanced at Ben, reading more tension in his posture, and said, "I was planning to light a fire in the living room fireplace. How are you at getting them started?"
"Fair,"
he smiled. "Then you get the job. It always takes me way too much newspaper and kindling."
"I'll see what I can do."
By the time Cassie came into the living room carrying a tray, Ben had the fire going briskly. He had shed his suit jacket and rolled up his shirt sleeves and was standing by the fireplace, loosening his tie. Cassie put the tray on the coffee table and sat down at one end of the sofa. "I think there's a knack to lighting fires," she said, pouring the coffee. "I don't have it. You obviously do. Thanks."
"My pleasure."
Ben watched Max carry a rawhide bone in from the kitchen, eye the fire distrustfully for a moment, then collapse on a rug not too far from Cassie. "We're getting into a routine," she said. "I give him a rawhide bone about this time, and it takes him the rest of the night to demolish it." She held out Ben's cup, and when he came to take it, added, "Have a seat." He chose the other end of the sofa and sat half-turned so he could look at her.
"I hope I'm not disrupting your routine."
"No. I've been sorting through some of Aunt Alex's things, but taking my time." She gestured toward a large box occupying a nearby chair. "That's mostly papers, correspondence and the like. I'll probably go through it tonight, but there's no hurry."
"So you haven't been bothered by anything else?"
Cassie shook her head and sipped her coffee. "No, nothing. I would have called the sheriff and offered to try again, but I imagine he's determined to try all the normal lines of investigation first. He won't look to me until he gets really desperate."
Ben didn't smile. "Do you think he will?"
"If you mean, do I think the killing is over? No, I don't."
"Why not? Maybe three satisfied him."
"I don't think so. There's a need in this one. A hunger. Killing appeases something inside him. The terror of his victims appeases something inside him. But he isn't sated yet. He'll kill again."
"It's like waiting for the other shoe to drop," Ben said. "Matt's investigation hasn't uncovered anything new.
or at least not anything helpful. No witnesses have come forward. There are no viable suspects. And the whole town is holding its breath.
Cassie refused to say it for him. She merely waited. Ben shook his head.
Maybe Matt's willing to wait and depend on traditional police methods, but I'm not. Not when there's another option. Cassie, would you try again? See if you can pick up any new information? Something that might help us catch this bastard before he kills again?
What would the sheriff say about that?
He said plenty, Ben replied with a grimace. Especially when I said I didn't want to bring you to his office and draw attention with everybody in town so edgy and watchful. He refused to come out here, and didn't want to let me bring something you could touch. But he finally gave in, probably to get me out of his office.
So you weren't just in the neighborhood, huh? He hesitated.
I would have called first, but I wanted to see you before I asked you to try again. Make sure you weren't as drained as you were before. To be honest, I drove around for half an hour before I could convince myself I had to ask you.
Cassie could believe that. It explained his disquiet since arriving. He was beginning to understand how much it took out of her, and he was torn between need and the reluctance to cause hurt. It's all right, you know, she said. I did agree to try to help. He gave her a quick look.
You wanted to stop, Cassie. We both know that.
And we also both know I don't have a choice. Not if I stay here. She paused. And I'm staying here. So, let's see whatever it is you've brought for me to touch. Ben set his cup on the coffee table and went to get his jacket from a chair near the fireplace. When he came back to the sofa, he was holding a small plastic bag labeled Evidence. Inside the bag was a scrap of drab-colored cloth.
Matt said this might tell you something.
Cassie put her cup on the coffee table and then took the bag from him and opened it. She braced herself mentally, closed her eyes, then held the scrap of cloth between her fingers. Ben watched her. Since the night she had been unable to read him even after touching him, he thought she was a bit less wary in his presence. She was definitely making eye contact more often than she had at first. But she was still very much shut inside herself, guarded and watchful. Her smiles were almost always brief, her eyes unreadable. And though the strain he had seen at their first meeting was still visible in the faint shadows under her eyes, she seemed somehow less torn by it, as though acceptance of the situation had bred a kind of peace.
Or a kind of fatalism.
That bothered Ben. This feeling that Cassie was resigned to a fate she was convinced lay in store for her. She hadn't had to tell him that the fate she saw for herself wasn't a happy one. It had been obvious. And that had been the reason he had driven around arguing with himself before finally coming to her. Not because an attempt would most likely drain her, but because he couldn't shake the feeling that with each attempt she was moving nearer a destiny that would take her far beyond his reach, maybe beyond anyone's reach. And she knew it. He made himself put that aside for the moment, and was about to ask her if she sensed anything, when her sudden smile threw him off balance.
Cassie? Does it tell you anything?
She opened her eyes, the smile lingering. As a matter of fact, it does. She returned the scrap to the plastic bag and dropped it carelessly onto the sofa between them. It tells me the good sheriff has a sense of humor, as well as a suspicious nature. I wasn't entirely sure about that.
What are you talking about?
It's a test, Ben. A test for me. She was still smiling. I invited him to do it, actually, so I can't complain. Ben picked up the evidence bag.
Are you telling me this didn't come from any of the crime scenes?
Afraid not.
Then where the hell did it come from?
As I said, The sheriff has a sense of humor. That scrap of material is from his own Boy Scout uniform.
Son of a bitch.
Don't be too hard on him. I knew he wouldn't refuse a challenge, and I gave him one. To test me, unexpectedly. That's why he refused to come along, of course. He's such an open book, I would easily have read his intentions. He's sure I can do that, even if he'd argue there's nothing paranormal about it. This way, he's not here, and even if I could read you, you had no idea the so-called evidence wasn't genuine. Grimly, Ben said,
I certainly didn't.
Cassie shrugged. Well, I passed his little test. It won't convince him, but it should at least give him pause. Maybe in the end that'll be worth something. Ben heard himself say,
What is the end, Cassie? Can you tell me that?
She looked away, amusement fading. I told you I can't see the future.
But you saw yours. Your fate.
That's different.
Is it? Can you tell me your fate isn't tangled up with this investigation?
Her profile was still, expressionless, as she gazed toward the fireplace, and her voice was calm when she said, I can't tell you anything about my fate.
Why not?
Because it's mine. Because telling you could somehow be the spur to make it all happen, just as I saw it.
And what if not telling me is the spur? Can you be sure it isn't?
No.
Then,
I had to make a choice, Ben. Act in any way to try to change what I saw, or not act. I acted. I ran 3,000 miles. And in running, in acting to try to change what had to be, I put myself right back into the kind of situation I was running from. She turned her head and looked at him at last, smiling faintly. I don't think I'll act anymore.
You acted by agreeing to help us.
No, that was just one foot following the other. I'm here. Trying to help is the logical, natural thing to do. I'm not trying to change fate. I'm just doing what I have to do.
You saw your own death, didn't you?
No. He frowned at her.
You're lying to me.
No, I'm not. I did not see my own death.
Then what did you...
Ben, I don't want to talk about this. It won't do either of us any good. Just... stop feeling guilty for pressing me to help, all right?
Is it that obvious?
To me it is. Can we change the subject now? He nodded slowly.
All right. Tell me something. When you took my hand outside a little while ago, were you able to read me?
No.
Then it wasn't because you were tired before.
No, it wasn't. I can't read you. You have walls. His gaze was intent.
What does that mean?
Cassie hesitated. I'm not so sure you want to talk about this.
Why wouldn't I?
Because it's been my experience that people have walls for a reason. To protect themselves. To keep other people out. To reveal as little of themselves as possible.
Are you saying these walls exist because I deliberately built them?
Deliberately, probably. Consciously, probably not. Ben, I'm not making some kind of accusation. We all have defense mechanisms. She watched him with a slight frown, aware that she had touched a nerve and uncertain whether to continue. But something in his eyes made her go on. Most of us learn early to hide things about ourselves, to disguise what others see, and only those closest to us ever realize it. It's human nature. But for some people, hiding or disguising what's there is impossible, for one reason or another. Maybe because the inner pain is too great, or maybe just because the personality is particularly sensitive and empathetic.
It feels so much and so deeply that it has no defenses. So the mind, if it's strong enough, builds walls to protect itself. Cassie shook her head. Just like the defense mechanisms other people use, the walls usually pass unrecognized, even unnoticed except by those closest to you.
Unless you happen to meet a psychic, Ben said.
Psychics look beneath the surface. It's what we do.
And beneath my surface is a wall.
That bothers you.
Shouldn't it?
Slowly, Cassie said, it's there for a reason, Ben. It was put there for a reason. If and when it's no longer needed, it won't be there anymore.
Ben drew a breath. I see.
Cassie realized she hadn't in any way reassured him, but she didn't know what else to say.
I suppose I should be grateful. If not for my walls, you'd still be avoiding my eyes and doing your best not to touch me.
She nodded. Probably. Your walls mean I don't have to work so hard to keep my own in place. From my point of view, it's a welcome respite. Nice to be able to talk to someone and not have to worry about listening with the wrong sense. So far, it's just you, Abby, and Max.
You can't read Abby?
No.
She wouldn't have struck me as the kind of person who'd need walls, he mused.
Cassie smiled. Which only proves that hers work.
I guess so.
He hesitated, then said reluctantly,
I should probably go and let you get back to your sorting.
Old and solitary instincts prompted Cassie to agree that he should leave, but newer urges got in the way. His eyes were attentive, and that restlessness was back in his voice, and she didn't have to read his mind to know that he didn't want to leave her just yet. She wondered when it had gotten hard to breathe, and was vaguely surprised her voice sounded normal when she said, If you don't have other plans, I fixed a huge pot of soup yesterday, far too much for Max and me. You could stay a while, help us finish it. In the momentary silence between them, they could hear the whine of the wind as it built outside, and a sudden quiet rattle against the window panes announced the arrival of sleet.
It sounds like a perfect night for soup, Ben said. What can I do to help?
He moved very carefully, wary of the dog's keen ears, even with the noise of the building storm. Caution told him to stay back, but he wanted to get closer, close enough to see inside. So cozy in there. A nice fire in the fireplace. Lights and the appetizing aroma of good food making the kitchen warm and snug. Quiet voices that were comfortable with each other, and yet aware. The edges of their words blurred with longing.
They were oblivious of his watching eyes.
He stood outside, his collar turned up, and hat pulled low to protect his face from the stinging sleet. It was cold. His feet were cold. But he remained where he was for a long time, watching. She was protected. Not that it mattered.
Why didn't you tell me before now? Matt demanded.
Abby shrugged.
Because I didn't think you'd take it seriously.
Until a killer started butchering women.
She winced, but nodded. Matt shoved his plate back and made a rough sound.
You should have told me, damn it.
So you could do what?
A week ago, you would have scoffed. Told me I was foolish for letting some cockeyed prediction bother me.
And since then, what would you have done? Told me to get security installed, get a dog, be careful. All of which I've done.
Matt glanced at the big red dog sprawled near Abby's side of the kitchen table and could hardly help but say,
I wouldn't have told you to get a dog, at least not one so attached to you.
She smiled. I like my males possessive. But don't worry.
I've had a talk with Bryce. He won't try to get between us in bed again. Matt wasn't at all sure that having a talk with a dog could possibly do much good, and once more turned a jaundiced eye toward the Irish setter.
Yeah, right, Bryce. What kind of name is that for a dog?
Blame his former owners, not me. The beautiful dog lifted his head and looked at each of them briefly, tail thumping against the floor, then stretched out again with a gusty sigh. Matt returned his gaze to Abby.
He damn well better protect you, is all I've got to say.
I'm sure he'll do his best, she replied, rising to carry her plate to the sink. Matt followed suit with his own.
You could move in with me. My place has better security, and I'd be there with you every night.
Not until the divorce is final, Matt.
What would a few weeks matter?
I told you. I want to wait and see how Gary reacts when the divorce is final.
And what if he reacts violently?
Honey, the town's like a powder keg. Everybody's tense and jumpy. Gary may not need much to push him over the edge. She managed to smile. That's exactly why I don't intend to push him until I absolutely have to.
And if I have to, I'll lock his ass up in my jail until he learns how to be reasonable.
And the hell with due process?
You could file charges against him.
No. No, I won't do that. Not unless he forces me to.
Matt put his hands on her shoulders and turned her to face him. Abby, I know you say Gary hit you just that once, the night you told him to get out. But I've always been sure you weren't telling me everything.
Her gaze was fixed on his loosened tie. I told you the truth about that night.
About that night? Yes. But not the truth about it being the first time he hit you.
Despite her best efforts, Abby felt her eyes sting as they filled with tears. Shame crawled inside her. She hadn't wanted Matt to know what a weak creature she was.
Honey. He gently tipped her chin up so she'd look at him. You don't have to tell me about it until you're ready. But I want you to know something. Nobody has to tell me what kind of guts it took for you to throw him out. And nobody has to tell me how scared you were when you did it.
Abby blinked back the tears. I can't talk about him to you, Matt. I just can't.
Okay. Okay, sweetheart.
He pulled her into his arms and kissed her. The dog didn't growl in protest this time, so things were definitely improving on that end. But Abby was just a bit too tense in his arms, and the embers of rage glowed deep inside Matt. Given the chance, he knew he'd beat Gary Montgomery to a bloody pulp.
I could stay here tonight, he offered huskily.
No, you couldn't. Not all night. But her arms slid up around his neck and her body was relaxing, softening against his. For a while, though. You can stay for a while. And it seemed her talk with Bryce had done some good after all. The dog didn't even follow them to the bedroom. It was still well before midnight when Matt reluctantly pulled himself from Abby's bed and dressed. She got up as well, because she wasn't yet ready for sleep, and she needed to reset the security system behind him. She didn't bother to dress, just pulled on a robe and belted it tightly, then walked him to the front door.
Look how much it's snowed. Be careful driving home, she told him.
I will. And you be careful, especially later when you let the dog out, Matt told her.
I will. Don't worry. He kissed her a last time, then left, waiting on the front porch until he heard her throw the deadbolt. Abby went back into the kitchen.
You're a good boy,
she told Bryce, who was still lying patiently near the table. Let me just finish cleaning up in here, and I'll take you out one last time tonight. Like any housebroken dog, Bryce recognized the word out and sat up eagerly. But he was a very patient dog and whined only once while she finished cleaning up from supper. All right, let's go. She decided to take him through the back door so that he could run free in her fenced yard. That way, she didn't have to get dressed and could wait on the porch for him until he was ready to come in. With the dog at her side, she went to the back door and put the security system in a standby mode, then unlocked the door and pulled it open. She was barely able to grab Bryce by the collar when he lunged with a deep-throated snarl at the man standing on the top step. "Gary," she said. Chapter 10.
"All I know is what the sheriff and Judge Ryan said in the paper,"
Hannah Payne told her boyfriend worriedly as they sat in the kitchen drinking coffee and finishing the last of the muffins she'd fixed earlier. Joe was about to leave for his third shift job at the plant, and she was up because he was about to leave her alone in the house they shared. "Baby, he just wants to scare you girls into being careful, that's all," Joe said patiently. "And he's right. But so long as you are careful and don't go anyplace by yourself, you'll be fine. I checked all the doors and windows, locked everything up tight. You've got a dependable car, a cell phone, a pistol in the nightstand drawer, and Beeson." Half asleep under the kitchen table, the big mongrel thumped his tail against the floor in a brief response.
"I know, but..."
"Take him with you when you leave the house. And be sure you drive with all the doors locked. Don't open the doors here to anyone but me or your sister. Let the machine screen all the calls, and don't pick up if you don't know who it is." He smiled at her. "Just be careful, Hannah. If you're really scared, I'll take you and Beeson over to your sister's every night when I leave for work, and you can stay with them till morning."
"No, I don't want to do that. You know we always end up in a fuss over something stupid if we spend too much time together. I'll be okay here with Beeson."
"You sure?" He watched her intently. "I don't know if I can. But if you want, I'll try to get some time off maybe next week. We could drive up to the mountains. Unless they catch this bastard before then."
"Well, let's wait and see."
"I need to go ahead and put in for the time."
Hannah considered, then nodded. "I think I'd like to get out of town for a while. Even if they do catch him."
"Okay. I'll see if personnel can schedule me off for a few days. Just stop worrying, baby. Okay?"
"I'll try. But I need to get groceries tomorrow morning," she said.
"I'll be home by 8:30. I'll take you."
"You need to sleep."
"I can sleep later. Now come on. And lock the door behind me." Hannah went with him to the front door of their small house and kissed him goodbye, perhaps clinging a bit more than was her habit.
"Drive carefully. It's still snowing."
"I will. Don't worry."
Joe patted her on the bottom and whispered a lewd suggestion in her ear, which made her smile and remind him they didn't have time and he was going to be late for work. He grinned and winked at her. And then he was gone. Hannah locked the door behind him and checked the locks twice. She took Beeson with her when she finally went to bed, even though he was supposed to stay in his bed in the living room. She turned on the TV and watched a very old movie, just so she wouldn't have to listen to the thick silence of the snowy night.
"Gary?" Abby said.
He kept his gaze on the dog and didn't venture to cross the threshold.
"Where the hell did you get that?" he demanded.
Abby was about to answer him when it occurred to her that she didn't have to. "Gary, what are you doing here? It's nearly midnight." She made no attempt to quiet the tense, growling dog at her side. Gary tore his gaze from the dog and smiled at her. It was the charming smile she had fallen for as an 18-year-old girl, too young and inexperienced to worry about his brooding silences and bursts of jealous rage.
He'd been a strikingly handsome man then. At 40, he was thickening, around the middle and in his features. Too many years of indulging his temper and his appetites had left their mark.
I just came to see you, Abby. What's wrong with that?
She had been terrified, and fought not to let him see her overwhelming relief. He didn't know about Matt, at least not yet. If he had, he wouldn't have been able to keep quiet about it. In Gary, jealousy was immediate and unmistakable. Abby drew a breath and kept her voice even and without emotion. Gary, it's late. The weather's lousy, and I'm tired. And if that isn't enough, you must remember what Judge Ryan told you. You don't live here anymore, and if you keep showing up here unannounced, I'll get a restraining order. You don't want me to do that, do you? Talk about our business in court for everybody to know? It was the only real leverage she had against him, and she used it cautiously, so as not to use it up. Gary was a vice president at one of the local businesses, a real estate development company that was highly respected and very prominent in town, and his reputation meant a great deal to him. A divorce was one thing. A divorce from a wife claiming physical and emotional abuse during a 13-year marriage was something else entirely. She had gone to Ben Ryan the day after she'd ordered Gary, at the point of his own gun, to leave. He had listened to her story, the whole sad and messy story Matt still didn't know, and had given her both genuine compassion and excellent legal advice. Even more, he had paid Gary a discreet visit, and had made it very plain to her husband that he could either quietly agree to an uncontested divorce, or find himself charged with assault and battery, and divorced on the grounds of extreme cruelty. In the months since then, Gary had been relatively cooperative, though at first prone to show up at the house from time to time. When she had gotten involved with Matt only a few months after her separation, Abby had grown fearful that her volatile husband would appear at just the wrong moment. Combine Gary's violent jealousy with Matt's fierce protectiveness, and the meeting could only end in tragedy. Once again she had gone to Ben, though this time withholding the relevant fact of her involvement with another man. And once again he had visited Gary, this time to explain that unsolicited visits would not be tolerated. Gary had been very quiet since then. Too quiet. Now he scowled at her.
I suppose you'll go running to Ryan again, just because I wanted to see you. It's a sad thing when a man can't talk to his own wife, Abby.
Bryce's growls grew louder as he either sensed her growing tension or heard the menace in Gary's voice. Abby allowed the dog's growls to fill the silence for a moment, then said, Gary, our divorce will be final in just about 3 weeks. I am not your wife. Not anymore. There's nothing you have to say to me that I'm the least bit interested in hearing, except goodbye. Please close the gate as you leave. His scowl intensified, but his voice was low, almost gentle.
You really shouldn't talk to me like that, Abby. Until those final papers are signed, you're still my wife. And a wife should never say such things to her husband. Not if she knows what's good for her.
Abby felt an all too familiar chill of fear and fought to keep him from seeing how easily he could still manipulate her emotions. In 30 seconds, I'm going to let go of this dog. From the sound of him, I don't think he'll need any encouragement at all to take a few pieces out of you. And while he's doing it, I'll be calling the sheriff. Maybe he remembered that shotgun she had pointed at him on his last night in this house. Or maybe Gary simply recognized that Abby wasn't going to back down this time. In any case, he was the one who retreated, slowly, down the steps. And Gary, he looked at her silent, face hard. Just so you know, if anything happens to this dog, like poison, for instance, or a stray shot from some anonymous hunter's gun,
or even a car that doesn't stop. I'm going to give your name to the sheriff." His expression darkened just a bit, proving to Abby that she did indeed know her husband. Then he swore beneath his breath and stalked away. She heard the gate open and then close with a loud click. Abby stood stiffly, listening until she heard a car start up nearby, then the crunch of tires on the snowy street and the engine fading into the distance. Then she slumped against the door jamb. She really needed to get a padlock for the gate, a strong one, and the security company had recommended shrubbery lights and a post lamp at the front walkway so that no one could approach the house at night unseen. Burglars, they'd said, tended to avoid houses with good perimeter lighting. She wondered if violent ex-husbands would. Bryce was whimpering softly, obviously disturbed. Abby managed to get hold of herself enough to take him out onto the porch, but the dog refused to move more than a few feet away from her, lifting his leg against the nearest bush and returning quickly to her. Maybe it was the cold or the snow still drifting lazily downward that made him disinclined to linger. Or maybe he simply knew that he needed to remain close. Abby brought him back inside and locked the door, then reset the security system. "Tomorrow," she told the dog as she dried his feet and brushed a bit of snow from his glossy red coat, "we're calling the security company and getting those lights put in, and we'll get a padlock for the back gate." Her voice was calm, but her heart still thudded, and that horrible cold knot of anxiety that Gary always created lay huge and heavy in the pit of her stomach. She was afraid. She hated to be afraid. "I don't want to scare you, Abby, but you have to be careful. I saw a possible future for you, and it isn't good. There's a chance. I saw him kill you, Abby. I couldn't see his face, and I don't know who he is, but he was enraged, cursing, and his hands were on your throat." "What? What are you saying?" "I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. You have to be careful. He's a madman, sick in his mind, and he'll kill you unless... unless... The future is not static, Abby. Even prophecies are not always what the seer interprets them to be." That had been Alexandra Melton's warning, and all she would say. Since Abby had only a few days earlier thrown her abusive husband out of the house, she had been half convinced it had been her own fear and anxiety the older woman sensed, that the prophecy had arisen from that. Still, she had continued to be wary, to take care. Given Gary's propensity toward violence, it had been obvious to her that if Alexandra had indeed seen a future event, the madman in her vision would certainly be him. Until, as Matt had baldly stated, a killer had begun butchering women. Now she had to be wary, not only of her ex-husband, but of virtually every other man as well. They were certainly not reassuring thoughts that followed Abby to bed that night. And when Bryce looked at her with pleading eyes, she allowed the big dog to stretch out happily beside her. She kept her hand on him all night. February 25th, 1999. Cassie woke in the morning with a sense of expectancy. She lay in bed for some minutes, thinking, aware from the brightness of the room that it had snowed considerably more during the night, but in no hurry to get up and look. Her sleep had been unusually restful, dreamless as far as she remembered, and she felt better than she had in a long, long time. The evening with Ben had been surprising. As he had noted, she was able to relax her guard in his company, yet even as her extra senses lay peacefully dormant, the other five had awakened with a vengeance. She had been hyper-aware of him, of his voice, his movements and gestures, his smiles, especially his smiles, and oddly aware of his awareness. She found that strange because it was something completely new for her. Always before, either she could read a man, such as the sheriff, or she couldn't. If she couldn't,
It meant he was a closed book to her, revealing nothing of himself that wasn't visible. Perhaps because of the violent male minds she had routinely dipped into her entire adult life, Cassie had seldom felt more than a fleeting interest in any man personally. And even when the natural urges and drives of a healthy young female body had presented themselves, she'd had little difficulty in pushing them from her consciousness. When one's only experience of sex lay in horrible mental images of unspeakable violence and death, accompanied by terror and agony, it was virtually reflexive to completely avoid even the possibility of becoming involved with any man. So Cassie knew herself to be dangerously isolated and inexperienced when it came to saner human emotions, and ridiculously ignorant about the physical side of a normal male-female relationship. Ben was attracted to her. She was sure of it. She knew she was attracted to him. Instincts she hardly understood told her that the attraction was strong and intensifying, and that it was only a matter of time before... Before what? Before they ended up in bed together? Before they fell in love? Before he swept her off her feet and into some absurd emotional fairy tale she hadn't believed in since she was 8, and possibly not even then? Cassie threw back the covers as she sat up. Her earlier sense of happy expectancy deflated. She was, she told herself, being an absolute idiot. For the first time in her adult life, she had been thrown into the company of a handsome, sexy man